Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to start a new book, and it's more than just a book. It's one of the most insightful, sickening things ever published. Its origins are obscure and debated, but that it appears to contain something that's pretty darn close to the truth about the mindset and intentions of the people actually running the world, to me, is undeniable. And I say that as someone with no taste at all for biblical explication or exegesis or anything that's not front and center for what it is. But what this is the Protocols of Zion. I've got that red-orange copy with a preface and explanatory notes. So in this part one, we're going to do this in about 10 sessions. It's about 300 total pages, but the Protocols is in the middle of that, and we're going to start off with some stuff from Henry Ford, which we have covered over other places, but it won't hurt to redo some of it here. Then we'll get into the Protocols, and then we have also introductory material and setup that are included in this book itself. Example of part, it's got four total parts. Part one is the Henry Ford material we're going to go over today. Part two, how the Protocols came to Russia, how an American edition was suppressed, more attempts at refutation, and then finally the text and commentary. And then part three, you actually have the Protocols themselves. Basically what it is apparently notes taken by someone who is hearing these as part of a lecture that the Jews might give to the people they trained up to be administrators of the coming world. We've heard a lot about the Protocols in Henry Ford, and we're going to start, as I said, with Henry Ford. We'll do part one in about three sections, then we'll move on to part two. Part three and part four includes Fabianism, a 10-year plan for socialists. These are chapters. Excerpts from Congressman L.T. McFadden's speech, The Organization on British Slavery in Conclusion. So, yeah, about 300 pages, about 10 sessions. Let's get started with part one. We'll do two chapters. The Jewish Question, Fact or Fancy? And then, does a definite Jewish world program exist? But first, let's start from the beginning, looking at the cover again. This is the orange, red-orange, the Protocols of Zion, it says in the front cover, with preface and explanatory notes. Back cover is absolutely empty, just red-orange. Opening it, we see, United we stand, divided we fall. The Protocols of the Meetings of the Learned Elders of Zion. With preface and explanatory notes, translated from the Russian text by Victor E. Marsden, formerly Russian correspondent of the Morning Post. So translated from Russian by a British correspondent for the Morning Post, 1934 is the date on that. And then you flip the page over, and Sergius A. Nihlus, first publisher of the Protocols in 1901. So the Protocols were from before 1900. Then the index listing what we've essentially the table of contents, as I already stated, and then moving on, the preface from Victor Marsden, the correspondent for the Morning Post. Brief, but two pages, we'll read that. Now, the author of this translation of the famous Protocols was himself a victim of the revolution. He had lived for many years in Russia and was married to a Russian lady. Among his other activities in Russia, he had been for a number of years Russian correspondent on the Morning Post, a position which he occupied when the revolution broke out, and his vivid descriptions of events in Russia will still be in the recollection of many of the readers of that journal. Naturally, he was singled out for the anger of the Soviet. Soviet is like a council. On the day that Captain Cromie, C-R-O-M-I-E, was murdered by Jews, Victor Marsden was arrested and thrown into the Peter Paul prison, expecting every day to have his name called out for execution. This, however, he escaped, and eventually he was allowed to return to England very much of a wreck in bodily health. However, he recovered under treatment and the devoted care of his wife and friends. One of the first things he undertook as soon as he was able was this translation of the protocols. Mr. Marsden was eminently well qualified for the work. His intimate acquaintance with Russia, Russian life and the Russian language on the one hand, and his mastery of a terse literary English style on the other, placed him in a position of advantage which few others could claim. The consequences that we have in his version, an eminently readable work, and the subject matter is somewhat formless. Mr. Marsden's literary touch reveals the thread running through the 24 protocols. The summary placed at the head of each is Mr. Marsden's own, and will be found very useful in acquiring a comprehensive view of its scope. It may be said with truth that this work was carried out at the cost of Mr. Marsden's own life's blood. He told the writer of this preface that he could not stand more than an hour at a time of his work on it in the British Museum, which is also where Karl Marx wrote Das Kapital, as the diabolical spirit of the matter, which he was obliged to turn into English, made him positively ill. And I have to say, that's how I felt the first time I read it. It was a sinking feeling in my stomach, equivalent only to the horror at realizing the depth of the Jewish plans and perfidy and The Ordeal of Civility by John Murray Cudahy, which we're also going to do as an audiobook, roughly the same time or as we're doing the protocols here. We're now on page 6, two more paragraphs in the preface. So the guy was so sickened by the material he's translating from Russian into English that he could only do an hour at a time translating it. Mr. Marsden's connection with the Morning Post was not severed by his return to England, and he was well enough to accept the post of special correspondent of that journal in the suite of HRH, His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, on his Empire tour. From this, he returned with the Prince, apparently in much better health, but within a few days of his landing, he was taken suddenly ill and died after a very brief illness. His sudden death is still a mystery, in italics. May this work be his crowning monument. In it, he has performed an immense service to the English-speaking world, and there can be little doubt that it will take its place in the first rank of the English versions of, quote, the protocols of the meetings of the learned elders of Zion. And that would be the end of the preface on page 6. Moving to part 1. Now we're setting it up. As I said, in this one, we're going to go through page 31, cover a couple of these early articles. This is before we get to the actual protocols themselves. So, part one, a selection of the articles, 1920 to 1922, published by Mr. Henry Ford's paper, The Dearborn Independent, The Jewish Question, Fact or Fancy? And again, we've covered the complete, comprehensive international Jew, the world's foremost problem, in our audiobooks at vnnforum.com. So if you want to hear all that, but it can never hurt to repeat. So here's a selection that we'll get into today. It begins, the chief difficulty in writing about the Jewish question is the supersensitiveness of Jews and non-Jews concerning the whole matter. There is a vague feeling that even to openly use the word Jew, or to expose it nakedly to print, is somehow improper. Polite evasions like Hebrew and Semite, both of which are subject to the criticism of inaccuracy, are timidly essayed, and people pick their way gingerly as if the whole subject were forbidden, until some courageous Jewish thinker comes straight out with the good old word Jew, and then the constraint is relieved and the air cleared. The word Jew is not an epithet. It is a name, ancient and honorable, with significance for every period of human history, past, present, and to come. I disagree with the honorable part. Again, this is written in 1920 to 22, The Jewish Question, Fact or Fancy. And again, there is extreme sensitiveness about the public discussion of the Jewish question on the part of Gentiles. They would prefer to keep it in the hazy borderlands of their thought, shrouded in silence. Their heritage of tolerance has something to do with their attitude, but perhaps their instinctive sense of the difficulty involved has more to do with it. The principal public Gentile pronouncements upon the Jewish question are in the matter of truckling politician or the pleasant after-dinner speaker. The great Jewish names in philosophy, medicine, literature, music, and finance are named over. The energy, ability, and thrift of the race are dwelt upon, and everyone goes home feeling that a difficult place has been rather neatly negotiated. But nothing has changed thereby. The Jew is not changed. The Gentile is not changed. The Jew still remains the enigma of the world. Gentiles' sensitiveness on this point is best expressed by the desire for silence. Why discuss it at all, in quotes, is the attitude. Such an attitude is itself a proof that there is a problem which we would evade if we could. Why discuss it at all? The keen thinker clearly sees in the implications of such a question the existence of a problem whose discussion or suppression will not always be within the choice of easygoing minds. Is there a Jewish question in Russia? Unquestionably, in its most virulent form. Is it necessary to meet that question in Russia? Undoubtedly, meet it from every angle along which light and healing may come. The thing is to interject here. Henry Ford believed that naming the Jew, which I believe he was the first to say that, and simply talking about it openly would clear up the problem. That, however, proved very, very far from the case. Well, the percentage of the Jewish population of Russia is just 1% more than it is in the United States. The majority of the Jews themselves are not less well-behaved in Russia than they are here. They lived under restrictions which do not exist here. Yet in Russia, their genius has enabled them to attain a degree of power which has completely baffled the Russian mind. Whether you go to Romania, Russia, Austria, or Germany, or anywhere else the Jewish question has come to the forefront as a vital issue, you will discover that the principal cause is the outworking of the Jewish genius to achieve the power of control. Again, this is written 10, 12 years before the Nazis take power in Germany. Here in the United States, it is the fact of this remarkable minority, a sparse Jewish ingredient of 3% in a nation of 110 million, attaining in 50 years a degree of control that would be impossible to a 10 times larger group of any other race. So in 50 years, they got more control than 10 times their number could have got other places. 3% of any other people would scarcely occasion comment because we would not be meet with a representative of them whenever we went in the high places, in the innermost secrecy of the councils of the Big Four at Versailles, in the Supreme Court, these are all semicolon together, in the councils of the White House, in the vast dispositions of world finance, wherever there is power to get or use. Yet we meet the Jew everywhere in the upper circles, literally everywhere there is power. He has the brains, the initiative, the penetrative vision, which almost automatically projects him to the top, and as a consequence, he is more marked than any other race. And that is where the Jewish question begins. It begins in very simple terms. How does the Jew so habitually and so resistlessly gravitate to the highest places? What puts him there? Why is he put there? What does he do there? What does the fact of his being there mean to the world? That is the Jewish question in its origin. From those points, it goes on to others, and whether the trend becomes pro-Jewish or anti-Semitic depends on the amount of prejudice brought to the inquiry, and whether it becomes pro-humanity depends on the amount of insight and intelligence. The use of the word humanity in connection with the word Jew throws a side meaning which may not be intended. In this connection, it is usually understood that the humanity ought to be shown toward the Jew. There is just as great an obligation upon the Jew to show his humanity toward the whole race. The Jew has been too long accustomed to think of himself as exclusively the claimant on the humanitarianism of society. Society has a large claim against him that he cease his exclusiveness, that he cease exploiting the world, that he cease making Jewish groups the end-all and the be-all of his gains, and that he begin to fulfill, in a sense, his exclusiveness, his exclusiveness has never yet enabled him to fulfill the ancient prophecy that through him all the nations of the earth should be blessed. I think it's completely politically wrong-headed to proceed on this track. Now, the U.S. was more religious back then, but still, the minute you get into accepting anything in that book is real or is signifying something other than complete Jew first balderdash, you open the door to the Jew being justified in the minds of goy folk as being somehow superior, distinct, apart, and deserving of that. It's best just to say, what are the Jews objectively, scientifically? What have they actually done in their history? And how, given the way they behave, would we be wise to treat them if we desire to exist on terms worth existing? I mean, his title says Jews are the world's foremost problem, but one or two pages in, he's already seeded that they're a special race and an honorable one. So this is not the way to go. Moving on to page 10, as I said, we're going to run up through 31, the end of a couple of articles. The Jew cannot go on forever fulfilling the role of suppliant for the world's humanitarianism. He must himself show that quality to a society which seriously suspects his higher and more powerful groups of exploiting it with a pitiless rapacity which, in its wide-flung and long-drawn-out distress, may be described as an economic program against a rather helpless humanity. So be humanitarian towards me, even as I rip you off and steal your money and enslave you, and steal your purchasing power through the Fed, etc., etc. For it is true that society is as helpless before the war well-organized extortions of certain financial groups as huddled groups of Russian Jews were helpless against the anti-Semitic mob. And as in Russia, so in America, it is the poor Jew who suffers for the delinquencies of the rich exploiter of his race. This series of articles is already being met by an organized barrage by mail and wire and voice, every single item of which carries the wail of persecution. One would think that a heartless and horrible attack were being made on the most pitiable and helpless people, until one looks at the letterheads of the magnates who write, and at the financial ratings of those who protest, and at the membership of the organizations whose responsible heads hysterically demand retraction. And always in the background there's the threat of a boycott, a threat which has practically sealed up the columns of every publication in America against even the mildest discussion of the Jewish question. Please again remember this was written in 1920-22, when newspapers were the dominant medium, even more than the coming radio and before the invention of TV. So the Jews, controlling most of the advertising, could essentially, because their threat of boycott was very realistic and pulled off in a number of instances, plausibly threaten anyone who wrote about them objectively with the denial of the funds they needed to continue their media operation. That's what he's talking about. The Jewish question in America cannot be concealed forever by threats against publications, nor by the propagandist publication of matter extremely and invariably favorable to everything Jewish. To interject again, just imagine you reading this will have long known the internet as long as you've been alive, perhaps. And that allows peer-to-peer communication. But back then, how would you learn about Jews? How would you learn about anything? It would be through printed matter, which is harder to circulate by far than electronic matter that's in every home. So he's saying the Jewish question cannot be concealed forever by threats. It is here, and it cannot be twisted into something else by the adroit use of propaganda, nor can it be forever silenced by threats. The Jews of the United States can best serve themselves and their fellow Jews all over the world by letting drop their far too ready cry of anti-Semitism, by adopting a franker tone than that which benefits a helpless victim, and by seeing what the Jewish question is and how it behooves every Jew who loves his people to help solve it. There has been used in this series the term international Jew, in quotes. It is susceptible of two interpretations. One, the Jew, wherever he may be. The other, the Jew who exercises international control. The real contention of the world is with the latter and his satellites, whether Jew or Gentile. Now, this international type of Jew, he'd be talking about George Soros type, this grasper after world control, this actual possessor and wielder of world control, is a very unfortunate connection for his race to have. The most unfortunate thing about the international Jew, from the standpoint of the ordinary Jew, is that the international type is also a Jew. And the significance of this is that the type does not grow anywhere else than on a Jewish stem. There is no other racial nor national type which puts forth this kind of person. Again, we're reading the introduction to the protocols where they're talking about specially training up Jews to be administrators and administer the world in ways that Goyim never are. So that's why this article was selected. This type does not grow anywhere else than on a Jewish stem. There is no other racial or national type which puts forth this kind of person. It is not merely that there are a few Jews among the international financial controllers. It is that the world controllers are exclusively Jews. That is the phenomenon which creates an unfortunate situation for those Jews who are not, and never shall be, world controllers, who are the plain people of the Jewish race. If world control were mixed, like the control, say, of the biscuit business, then the occasional Jews we might find in those higher financial altitudes would not constitute the problem at all. The problem would then be limited to the existence of world control in the hands of a few men, of whatever race or lineage they might be. But since world control is an ambition which has only been achieved by Jews, and not by any of the methods usually adopted by the would-be world conquerors, it becomes inevitable that the question should center in that remarkable race. This brings another difficulty. In discussing this group of world controllers under the name of Jews, and they are Jews, it is not always possible to stop and distinguish the group of Jews that is meant. The candid reader can usually determine that, but the Jew who is in a state of mind to be injured is sometimes pained by reading as a charge against himself what was intended for the upper group. Then why not discuss the upper group as financiers and not as Jews, may be asked. Because they are Jews. Is it not to the point to insist that in any list of rich men there are more Gentiles than Jews? We're not talking about merely rich men who have, many of them, gained their riches by serving a system. We are talking about those who control, and it is perfectly apparent that merely to be rich is not to control. The world-controlling Jew has riches, but he also has something much more powerful than that. The international Jew, as already defined, rules not because he is rich, but because in a most marked degree he possesses the commercial and masterful genius of his race and avails himself of a racial loyalty and solidarity, the like of which exists in no other human group. In other words, transfer today the world control of the international Jew to the hands of the highest commercially talented group of Gentiles, and the whole fabric of world control would eventually fall to pieces. Because the Gentile lacks a certain quality, be it human or divine, be it natural or acquired, that the Jew possesses. This, of course, the modern Jew denies. There is a new position taken by the modernists among the Jews, which constitutes a denial that the Jew differs from any other man except in the matter of religion. Jew, they say, is not a racial designation, but a religious designation, like Episcopalian, Catholic, Presbyterian. This is the argument used in newspaper offices in the Jews' protests against giving the Jewish designation to those of their people who are implicated in crime, Bernie Madoff. You don't give the religious classifications of other people who are arrested, the editor is told. Why should you do it with Jews? The appeal to religious tolerance always wins and is sometimes useful in diverting attention from other things. Well, if the Jews are only religiously differentiated from the rest of the world, the phenomenon grows stranger still, for the rest of the world is interested less in the Jews' religion than in anything else that concerns him. There is really nothing in his religion to differentiate the Jew from the rest of mankind as far as the moral content of the religion is concerned, and if there were, he would have overcome that by the fact that his Jewish religion supplies the moral structure for both of the other great religions. Well, the Jews' religion does say in the Talmud, even the best of the Goyim should be killed. That's not really the same as what the Muslims say. The Muslims say that everyone should be converted to Islam and jihad, or religious war, is one of their tenets, and the Christians also say everyone should be converted, although they say they should be converted in the sense not of having their head chopped off or being forced to submit or die, but in the sense of being persuaded. So there is that difference, although they're both universal. And the Jews' religion is not universal. It's for a specific people, so it's not at all actually like the other two races. He's crediting it with spawning. Moreover, it is stated that there are among English-speaking nations 2 million Jews who acknowledge their race, not their religion, while 1 million are classified as agnostic. Are these any less Jews than the others? The world does not think so, nor do rabbis. The authoritative students of human difference do not think so. An Irishman who grows indifferent to the church is still an Irishman, and it would seem to be equally true that a Jew who grows indifferent to the synagogue is still a Jew. He at least feels that he is, and so does the non-Jew. A still more serious challenge would arise if this contention of the modernists were true, for it would necessitate the explanation of these world-controlling Jews by their religion. We should have to say they excel through their religion, and then the problem would turn on the religion whose practice should bring such power and prosperity to its devotees. But another fact would intervene, namely that these world-controlling Jews are not notably religious, and still they're much more atheist than others. And still another fact would hammer for recognition, namely that the most devout believers and the most obedient followers of the Jewish religion are the poorest among the Jews. Not necessarily true today. If you want Jewish orthodoxy, the bracing morality of the Old Testament, you will find it not among the successful Jews who have Unitarianized their religion to the same extent that the Unitarians have Judaized their Christianity, but among the poor in the side streets who still sacrifice the Saturday business for their Sabbath keeping. That might have been true then. It's not true in 2020, where it might have been true in parts in 1920. Certainly their religion has not given them world control. Instead, they have made their own sacrifices to keep it inviolate against modernism. More about that in the Cudahy book. Of course, if the Jew differs from the rest of mankind only when he is in full accord with his religion, the question becomes very simple. Any criticism of the Jew becomes sheer religious bigotry and nothing else. And that would be intolerable. But it would be the consensus of thoughtful opinion that the Jew differs less in his religion than anything else. There is more difference between the two great branches of Christianity, more conscious difference, than between any branch of Christianity and Judaism. So that, if the contention of certain modernists notwithstanding, the world would go on thinking of the Jew as a member of a race whose persistence has defeated the utmost efforts made for its extermination, a race that has preserved itself in virility and power by the observance of those natural laws, the violation of which has mongrelized so many nations, a race which has come up out of the past with the two great moral values which may be reckoned on monotheism and monogamy, a race which today is before us as the visible sign of an antiquity to which all our spiritual wealth harks back. Nay, the Jew will go on thinking of himself as a member of a people, a nation, a race, and all the mixture and intermixture of thought and faith or custom cannot make it otherwise. A Jew is a Jew, and as long as he remains within his perfectly unassailable traditions, he will remain a Jew. And he will always have the right to feel that to be a Jew is to belong to a superior race. These world-controlling Jews at the top of affairs, then, are there by virtue of, among other things, certain qualities which are inherent in their Jewish natures. Every Jew has these qualities, even if not in the supreme sense, just as every Englishman has Shakespeare's tongue, but not in Shakespeare's degree. And thus it is impracticable, if not impossible, to consider the international Jew without laying the foundations broadly upon Jewish character and Jewish psychology. We may discount at once the too common libel that this greater form of Jewish success is built upon dishonesty. It is impossible to indict the Jewish people or any other people on a wholesale charge. No one knows better than the Jew how widespread is the notion that Jewish methods of business are all unscrupulous. There is no doubt a possibility of a great deal of unscrupulousness existing without actual legal dishonesty, but it is altogether possible that the reputation the Jewish people have long borne in this respect may have had other sources than actual and persistent dishonesty. Well, I'd say it's a dual code. It's how they treat non-Jews versus how they treat Jews. They're honest with their fellow Jews, by and large, and they're very shady if it benefits them with non-Jews. We may indicate one of these possible sources. The Jew at a trade is naturally quicker than most other men. They say that there are other races which are as nimble at a trade as is the Jew, but the Jew does not live much among them. In this connection, one may remember the famous joke about the Jew who went to Scotland. Now, it is human nature for the slower man to believe that the quicker man is too deft by far and to become suspicious of his deftness. Everybody suspects the sharper, even though his sharpness may be entirely honest. The slower mind is likely to conceive that the man who sees so many legitimate twists and turns to a trade may also see and use a convenient number of illegitimate twists and turns. Moreover, there is always the ready suspicion that the one who gets, quote, the best of the bargain, gets it by trickery, which is not above board. Slow, honest, plain-spoken, and straight-dealing people have always had their doubts about the man who gets the better of it. The Jews, as the records for centuries show, were a keen people in trade. They were so keen that many regarded them as crooked. And so the Jew became disliked for business reasons, not all of which were creditable to the intelligence or initiative of his enemies. Take, for example, the persecution which Jew merchants once suffered in England. In older England, the merchant class had many easygoing traditions. One tradition was that a respectable tradesman would never seek business, but wait for it to come to him. Another tradition was that to decorate one's store window with lights or colors, or to display one's stock of goods attractively in the view of the public, was a contemptible and underhanded method of tempting a brother tradesman's customers away from him. Still another tradition was that it was strictly unethical and unbusinesslike to handle more than one line of goods. If one sold tea, it was the best reason in the world why he should not sell teaspoons. As for advertising, the thing would have been so brazen and bold that public opinion would have put the advertiser out of business. The proper demeanor for a merchant was to seem reluctant to part with his goods. One may readily imagine what happened when the Jewish merchant bustled into the midst of the jungle of traditions. He simply broke them all. In those days, tradition had all the force of a divinely promulgated moral law, and in consequence of his initiative, the Jew was regarded as a great offender. A man who would break these trade traditions would stop at nothing. The Jew was anxious to sell. If he could not sell one article to a customer, he had on hand another to offer him. The Jew's stores became bazaars, forerunners of our modern department stores, and the old English custom of one store for one line of goods was broken up. The Jew went after a trade, pursued it, persuaded it. He was the originator of, quote, a quick turnover and small profits. He originated the installment plan. The one state of affairs he could not endure was business at a standstill, and to start it moving, he would do anything. He was the first advertiser in a day when even to announce in public prints the location of your store was to intimate to the public that you were in financial difficulties, were about to go to the wall, and were trying the last desperate expedient to which no self-respecting merchant would stoop. It was as easy as child's play to connect this energy with dishonesty. The Jew was not playing the game, at least so the staid English merchant thought. As a matter of fact, he was playing the game to get it all in his own hands, which he has practically done. The Jew has shown that same ability ever since. His power of analyzing the money currents amounts to an instinct. Funny echo there, but obviously many decades before of Follow the Money and Deep Throat and Woodward and Bernstein. His establishment in one country represented another base from which the members of his race could operate, whether by the natural outworking of innate gifts or the deliberate plan of race unity and loyalty. All Jewish trading communities had relations, and as these trading communities increased in wealth, prestige, and power, as they formed relations with governments and great interests in the countries where they operated, they simply put more power into the central community, wherever it might be located, now in Spain, now in Holland, now in England. Whether by intention or not, they became more closely allied than the branches of one business could be because of the cement of racial unity. The bond of racial brotherhood cannot in the very nature of things exist among the Gentiles as it exists among the Jews. Gentiles never think of themselves as Gentiles, and never feel they owe anything to another Gentile as such. Thus, they have been convenient agents of Jewish schemes at all times and in places where it was not expedient that the Jewish controllers should be publicly known. But they have never been successful competitors of the Jew in the field of world control. From these separated Jewish communities went power to the central community where the master bankers and the master analysts of conditions lived. And back from the central community flowed information of an invaluable character and assistance wherever needed. It is not difficult to understand how, under such a condition, ethnic networks were the first mass media, as it were, except it was a minority media rather than a mass media. But it was the way by which all these rabbis and these synagogues and these Jewish communities and these far-flung states communicated and knew stuff before the Goyim did. Early Facebook, right? Under such a condition, the nation that did not deal kindly with the Jews was made to suffer, and the nation that yielded to them their fullest desire was favored by them. And it is credibly stated that they have made certain nations feel the power of their displeasure. This system, if it ever existed, exists in greater power today. Yeah, I'm writing 1920-22. It is today, however, threatened as it has never been. 50 years ago, international banking, which was mostly in the control of Jews as the money brokers of the world, was on top of business. It exercised the super control of governments and finance everywhere. Then came that new thing, industry. Again, this is Henry Ford's paper we're talking about. Henry Ford being the quintessential prototype industrialist. Then came that new thing, industry, which expanded to a degree unguessed by the shrewdest prophets and analysts. As industry gathered strength and power, it became a powerful money magnet, drawing the wealth of the world in its train, not, however, merely for the sake of possessing the money, but of making it work. And he would make a big thing of Gentiles, Goyim, whites, making money, whereas Jews get money by any means. So finance ruled everything for 50 years till 1920, and then industry came into its own and started drawing a large amount of money. Not merely for the sake of possessing the money, but for making it work. Production and profit on production, instead of loans and interest on loans, became the master method for a time. The war came, in which the former broker masters of the world had undoubtedly their large part, the Bernard Baruchs. And now the two forces, industry and finance, are in a struggle to see whether finance is again to become the master or creative industry. This is one of the elements which is bringing the Jewish question to the bar of public opinion. And that was published in the Dearborn Independent, issue of June 12, 1920. Article the first, and then the second article we're going to cover today. Does a definite Jewish world program exist? And again, this is introductory material leading up to the protocols. In all the explanations of anti-Jewish feeling which modern Jewish spokesmen make, these three alleged causes are commonly given. These three and no more. Religious prejudice, economic jealousy, social antipathy. Whether the Jew knows it or not, every Gentile knows that on his side of the Jewish question, no religious prejudice exists. Economic jealousy may exist, at least to this extent, that his uniform success has exposed the Jew to much scrutiny. A few Jewish spokesmen seek to turn this scrutiny by denying that the Jew is preeminent in finance, but this is loyalty in extremity. The finances of the world are in control of the Jews. Their decisions and their devices themselves our economic law. But because a people excels us in finance is no sufficient reason for calling them to the bar of public judgment. If they are more intellectually able, more persistently industrious than we are, if they are endowed with faculties which have been denied us as an inferior race or slower race, that is no reason for our requiring them to give an account of themselves. Economic jealousy may explain some of the anti-Jewish feeling. It cannot account for the presence of the Jewish question, except as the hidden causes of Jewish financial success may become a minor element of the larger problem. And as for social antipathy, there are many more undesirable Gentiles in the world than there are undesirable Jews, for the simple reason that there are more Gentiles. None of the Jewish spokesmen today mention the political cause, or if they come within suggestive distance of it, they limit and localize it. It is not a question of the patriotism of the Jew, though this too is very widely questioned in all the countries. You hear it in England, in France, in Germany, in Poland, in Russia, in Romania, and, with a shock, you hear it in the United States. Books have been written, reports published, and scattered abroad, statistics skillfully set forth for the purpose of showing that the Jew does his part for the country in which he resides, and yet the fact remains that in spite of these most zealous and highly sponsored campaigns, the opposite assertion is stronger and lives longer. The Jews who did their duty in the armies of liberty, and it doubtless from true-hearted love and allegiance, have not been able to overcome the impression made upon officers and men and civilians by those who did not. But that is not what is here meant as the political element in the Jewish question. To understand why the Jews should think less of the nationalities of the world than do those who comprise them is not difficult. The Jews' history is one of wandering among them all. Considering living individuals only, there is no race of people now upon the planet who have lived in so many places, among so many peoples, as have the Jewish masses. They have a clearer world sense than any other people because the world has been their path. And they think in world terms more than any nationality, more than any nationally cloistered people could. The Jew can be absolved if he does not enter into national loyalties and prejudices with the same intensity as the natives. Example, as I write, the Jews have been disappointed by Trump because he threatens not to be the warmonger they want and not to enact the globalist open borders they want. In fact, to shut that down. And the son of the father of the neoconservatives, the Trotskyites, who essentially moved from being left-wingers to right-wingers and took over conservatism in the late 70s and early 80s, are so disgusted with Trump that Bill Kristol has formed a new party called the Renegade Party, I think it is, and he picked some complete cuck conservative to head it. A guy named David French is basically, I guess, a blogger at National Review, someone no one's really ever heard of, someone insignificant, in order to try to split the vote so that horror of horrors doesn't happen. Someone gets in there who represents American interests, and that means basically white interests, in terms of shutting down the border and not engaging in endless war, and all manner of lies and slander are being flung against Trump at this point as I come to you midway in 2016. Which doesn't matter, because the material we're dealing with here is evergreen. So long as Jews exist, they will operate in the ways that people are talking about. That's why it makes sense to read from a book that's 100 years old, the Protocols are 95 years old, and the Dearborn Independent 95 years old, and the Protocols are another 25 plus years on top of that. Long-ranging plans by this race to control the world. And he says, so even if there are Jews who serve loyalty, the basic perception is they are not loyal to their native country. They're people who've traveled all over the world, and they have a different perspective than nation-bound whites do. But that is not what here is meant as the political element in the Jewish question. To understand why the Jews should think less of the nationalities of the world than do those who comprise them is not difficult. The Jews' history is one of wandering among them all. Considering living individuals only, I guess I'm repeating myself, there is no race of people now upon the planet who have lived in so many places, among so many peoples, as have the Jewish masses. They have a clearer world sense than any other people because the world has been their path, and they think in world terms more than any nationally cloistered people could. The Jew can be absolved if he does not enter into national loyalties and prejudices with the same intensity as the natives. The Jew has been for centuries a cosmopolitan. While under a flag he may be correct in the conduct required of him as a citizen or resident, inevitably he has a view of flags which can hardly be shared by a man who has known but one flag. The flag to the Jew is something to be used, not something he feels loyalty to. The political element inheres in the fact that the Jews form a nation in the midst of the nations, echoing Jefferson. Some of their spokesmen, particularly in America, deny that, but the genius of the Jew himself has always put these spokesmen's zeal to shame. And why this fact of nationhood should be so strenuously denied is not always clear. It may be that when Israel is brought to see that her mission in the world is not to be achieved by means of the golden calf, her very cosmopolitanism with regard to the world and her inescapable nationalistic integrity with regard to herself will together prove a great and serviceable factor in bringing about human unity, which the total Jewish tendency at the present time is doing much to prevent. It is not the fact that the Jews remain a nation in the midst of the nations, it is the use made of that inescapable status which the world has found reprehensible. The nations have tried to reduce the Jew to unity with themselves. Attempts toward the same end have been made by the Jews themselves, but destiny seems to have marked them out to continuous nationhood. Both the Jews and the world will have to accept that fact, find the good prophecy in it, and seek the channels for its fulfillment. Or the world could just defend itself from Jews by wiping them out. Theodor Herzl, one of the greatest of the Jews, was perhaps the farthest-seeing public exponent of the philosophy of Jewish existence that modern generations have known. Again, writing, 25, 28 years before Israel's founding. And he was never in doubt about the existence of the Jewish nation. Indeed, he proclaimed its existence on every occasion. He said, "We are a people, one people." That's in quotes. Herzl, "We are a people, one people." He clearly saw that what he called the Jewish question was political. In his introduction to the Jewish state, he says, "I believe that I understand anti-Semitism, which is really a highly complex movement. I consider it from a Jewish standpoint, yet without fear or hatred. I believe that I can see what elements there are in it of vulgar sport, of common trade jealousy, of inherited prejudice, of religious intolerance, and also of pretended self-defense." Pretended self-defense. I think the Jewish question is no more a social than a religious one, notwithstanding that it sometimes takes these and other forms. It is a national question, which can only be solved by making it a political world question to be discussed and controlled by the civilized nations of the world in council. Not only did Herzl declare that the Jews formed a nation, but when questioned by Major Evans Gordon before the British Royal Commission on Alien Immigration in August 1902, Dr. Herzl said, "I will give you my definition of a nation, and you can add the adjective Jewish. A nation is, in my mind, an historical group of men of a recognizable cohesion held together by a common enemy. That is, in my view, a nation." Then if you add to that the word Jewish, you have what I understand to be the Jewish nation. Who's their enemy? Why, it's non-Jews. It's Gentiles. Also, in relating the action of this Jewish nation to the world, Dr. Herzl wrote, "When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. When we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse." This view, which appears to be the true view, and that it is the view which has been longest sustained in the Jewish thought, is brought out also by Lord Eustace Percy and republished, apparently with approval, by the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. It will repay a careful reading. Quote, "Liberalism and nationalism, with a flourish of trumpets, threw open the doors of the ghetto and offered equal citizenship to the Jew. The Jew passed out into the Western world, saw the power and the glory of it, used it and enjoyed it, laid his hand indeed upon the nerve centers of its civilization, guided, directed, and exploited it, and then refused the offer. Moreover, and this is the remarkable thing, the Europe of nationalism and liberalism, of scientific government and democratic equality, is more intolerable to him than the old oppressions and persecutions of despotism. In the increasing consolidation of the Western nations, it is no longer possible to reckon on complete toleration. In a world of completely organized territorial sovereignties, he, the Jew, has only two possible cities of refuge. He must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, which they're trying to do, or he must create a new territorial sovereignty of his own, and the Jew has in fact done both of those. Globalism for you, nationalism for the Jew. Nationalism for the Jew, globalism for you. Racism for the Jew, mongrelism for you. In this perhaps lies the explanation of both Jewish Bolshevism and of Zionism, for at this moment Eastern Jewry seems to hover uncertainly between the two. Quote, in Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism often seem to grow side by side, just as Jewish influence molded Republican and socialist thought throughout the 19th century, down to the Young Turk Revolution in Constantinople hardly more than a decade ago. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him. All that is true, and Jewish thinkers of the most fearless type always recognize it as true. The Jew is against the Gentile scheme of things. He is, when he gives his tendencies full sway, a Republican as against the monarchy, a socialist as against the Republic, and a Bolshevist as against socialism. What are the causes of this disruptive activity? First, his essential lack of democracy. Jewish nature is autocratic. Democracy is all right for the rest of the world, but the Jew, wherever he is found, forms an aristocracy of one sort or another. Democracy is merely a tool of a word which Jewish agitators use to raise themselves to the ordinary level in places where they are oppressed below it. But having reached the common level, they immediately make efforts for special privileges, as being entitled to them, a process of which the late peace conference will remain the most startling example. The Jews today are the only people whose special and extraordinary privileges are written into the world's treaty of peace. But more of that at another time. No one now pretends to deny, except a few spokesmen who really do not rule thought of the Jews, but are set forth for the sole benefit of influencing Gentile thought, that the socially and economically disruptive elements abroad in the world today are not only manned, but moneyed by Jewish interests. For a long time, this fact was held in suspense owing to the vigorous denial of the Jews and the lack of information on the part of those agencies of publicity to which the public had looked for its information. So they're concealing their control. That, oh yeah, we're the ones funding it. Oh yeah, we're the ones setting the agenda. Oh yeah, we're the ones who are the actual leaders. Oh yeah, we're the ones who are covering it all up with media that we pretend we don't control. But now the facts are coming forth. Herzl's words are being proved to be true. Quote, when we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. And these words were first published in English in 1896, or 24 years ago. Just now, these tendencies are working in two directions, one for the tearing down of the Gentile states all over the world, the other for the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. The latter project has the best wishes of the whole world, but it is far from having the best wishes of the whole or even the larger part of Jewry. The Zionist Party makes a great deal of noise, but it is really an unrepresentative minority. Again, this is written 25 years before Israel, or 28 years. It can scarcely be designated as more than an unusually ambitious colonization scheme. There's an asterisk which reads, note, the statements indicated are those of non-Zionist Jews. The real Jewish program is that the program is that program which is executed. It was the Zionist program that was followed by the peace conference. It must therefore be regarded as the official program. It is doubtless serving, however, as a very useful public screen for the carrying on of secret activities. International Jews, the controllers of the world's governmental and financial power, may meet anywhere, at any time, in war or peacetime, and by giving out that they are only considering the ways and means of opening up Palestine to the Jews, they easily escape the suspicion of being together on any other business. The allies and enemies of the Gentile nations at war thus met and were not molested. It was at a Zionist conference, the 6th, held in 1903, that the recent war was exactly predicted, its progress and outcome indicated, and the relation of the Jews to the peace treaty outlined. That is to say, though Jewish nationalism exists, its enshrinement in a state to be set up in Palestine is not the project that is engaging the whole Jewish nation now. The Jews will not move to Palestine just yet. It may be said that they will not move at all merely because of the Zionist quotation. Quite another motive will be the cause of the exodus out of the Gentile nations when the time for that exodus fully comes. As Donald A. Cameron, late British Consul General at Alexandria, a man in fully in sympathy with Zionism and much quoted in the Jewish press, says, quote, "The Jewish immigrants into Palestine will tire of taking in one another's washing at 3%, of winning one another's money in the family, and their sons will hasten by train and steamer to win 10% in Egypt. The Jew by himself in Palestine will eat his head off. He will kick his stable to pieces. Undoubtedly, the time for the exodus, at least the motive for the exodus, is not yet here." The political aspect of the Jewish question, which is now engaging at least three of the great nations, France, Great Britain, and the U.S., has to do with matters of the present organization of the Jewish nation. Must it wait until it reaches Palestine to have a state? Or is it an organized state now? Does Jewry know what it is doing? Has it a foreign policy, quote-unquote, with regard to the Gentiles? Has it a department which is executing that foreign policy? Has this Jewish state, visible or invisible, if it exists, a head? Has it a council of state? And if any of these things is so, who is aware of it? The first impulsive answer of the Gentile mind would be no to all these questions. It is a Gentile habit to answer impulsively. Never having been trained in secrets or invisible unity, the Gentile immediately concludes that such things cannot be, if for no other reason than that they have not crossed this path and advertised themselves. He can only think of others in his own terms, and how interesting that Christianity says, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But a corollary or variation of that would be, only perceive others as acting the way you would. Think that others are like you when they're not necessarily like you. They may be quite the opposite of you. But you're conditioned to think of them as the same as you. And to interpret all deviation as either a wrong, false perception or as deviating from your standard, when in fact you ought to look at it as part of, even if you're religious, God's created variety in the world and see what a thing actually is before you determine it. That would be a prejudice. Not in the sense of being against something, in the sense of not being able to understand something because you assume something that's not true. Why assume that all people are the same or like? And that goes for blacks as well as for Jews. The questions, however, answered thus, require some explanation of the circumstances which are visible to all men. If there is no deliberate combination of Jews in the world, then the control which they have achieved and the uniformity of the policies which they follow must be the simple result, not of deliberate decisions, but of a similar nature in all of them, working out the same way. This would be the hive mind, or the hive is what Joe Soberman used for liberalism. They don't need to have an overt conspiracy when they all think the same way and they all come from the same blood. They're all pushing the same agenda, basically inherently. Thus, we might say that as a love for adventure and the water drove the Britisher forth, so it made him the world's great colonist. Not that he deliberately sat down with himself and in a formal manner resolved that he would become a great colonizer, but the natural outworking of his genius resulted that way. But would this be a sufficient account of the British Empire? Doubtless the Jews have the genius to do, wherever they go, the things in which we see them excel. But does this account for the relations which exist between the Jews of every country, for their world councils, for their amazing foreknowledge of stupendous events, which break with shattering surprise on the rest of the world, for the smoothness and preparedness with which they appear at a given time in Paris, with a world program on which they all agree? And he's basically saying it's quite clear that they are consciously working together and developing plans and concealing those plans from us, and then breaking them on us at the appropriate time. The world has long suspected, at first only a few, then the secret departments of the governments, next the intellectuals among the people, now more and more the common people themselves, then not only are the Jews a nation distinct from all the other nations, and mysteriously unable to sink their nationality by any means they or the world may adopt to this end, but that they also constitute a state. They're not just a people, they're organized. The state would be the organized part. That they are nationally conscious, not only, but consciously united for a common defense and for a common purpose. I'd say a common agenda. An agreed upon strategy of attacking and dominating others. Revert to Theodor Herzl's definition of the Jewish nation as held together by a common enemy. And then reflect that this common enemy is the Gentile world. Does this people, which know itself to be a nation, remain loosely unorganized in the face of that fact, that they regard all Gentiles as enemies? It would hardly be like Jewish astuteness in other fields. When you see how closely the Jews are united by various organizations in the United States, so much that they have a Congress of the heads of major associations, so organized are they. And when you see how with practiced hand they bring those organizations to bear, as if with tried confidence in their pressure, it is at least not inconceivable that what can be done within a country can be done or has been done between all the countries where the Jews live. What can be done within a country has been done between all the countries where the Jews live. So they do the same thing within a nation, they also do among nations or between nations. At any rate, in the American Hebrew of June 25th, 1920, Herman Bernstein writes thus, quote, "About a year ago, a representative of the Department of Justice submitted to me a copy of the manuscript of The Jewish Peril by Professor Nilus, N-I-L-U-S, and asked for my opinion of the work. He said that the manuscript was a translation of a Russian book published in 1905, which was later suppressed. The manuscript was supposed to contain protocols of the wise men of Zion and was supposed to have been read by Dr. Herzl at a secret conference of the Zionist Congress at Basel, Switzerland. The manuscript had protocols that were supposed to have been read by Herzl at the Zionist Congress at Basel. He expressed the opinion that the work was probably that of Dr. Theodor Herzl. He said that some American senators who had seen the manuscript were amazed to find that so many years ago a scheme had been elaborated by the Jews, which is now being carried out, and that Bolshevism had been planned years ago by Jews who sought to destroy the world. This quotation is made merely to put on record the fact that it was a representative of the Department of Justice of the United States government who introduced this document to Mr. Bernstein and expressed a certain opinion upon it, namely, quote, that the work was probably that of Dr. Theodor Herzl. Probably that of Theodor Herzl, the protocols. Also that some American senators, quote-unquote, were amazed to note the comparison between what a publication of the year 1905 proposed and what the year 1920 revealed. So the Jews know literally decades ahead of hand what's going to happen because they're going to make it happen. The incident is all the more preoccupying because it occurred by action of the representative of a government who today is very largely in the hands of, or under the influence of, Jewish interests. It is more than probable that as soon as the activity became known, the investigator was stopped. But it is equally probable that whatever orders may have been given, and apparently obeyed, the investigation may not have stopped. The United States government was a little late in the matter, however. At least for other world powers had preceded it, some by many years. And it says at least four, that may be a misprint for F-O-U-R. A copy of the protocols was deposited in the British Museum and bears on it the stamp of that institution, August 10, 1906. The notes themselves probably date from 1896, or the year of the utterances previously quoted from Dr. Herzl. The first Zionist Congress convened in 1897. The document was published in England recently under auspices that challenged attention for it, in spite of the unfortunate title under which it appeared. Eyre and Spottiswood are the appointed printers to the British government, and it was they who brought out the pamphlet. It was as if the government printing office at Washington should issue them in this country. While there was the usual outcry by the Jewish press, the London Times, in a review, pronounced all the Jewish counterattacks as, quote, unsatisfactory, end quote. Quote, or in italics, the Times noticed what will probably be the case in this country also, that the Jewish defenders leave the text of the protocols alone while they lay heavy emphasis on the fact of their anonymity. When they refer to the substance of the document at all, there is one form of words which recurs very often. Quote, it is the work of a criminal or a madman. Unquote. The protocols, without name attached, appearing for the most part in manuscripts here and there, laboriously copied out from hand to hand, being sponsored by no authority that was willing to stand behind it, assiduously studied in the secret departments of the governments and passed from one to another among higher officials, have lived on and on, increasing in power and prestige by the sheer force of their contents, as few things do. A marvelous achievement for either a criminal or a madman. The only evidence it has is that which it carries within it, and that internal evidence is, as the London Times points out, the point on which attention is to be focused, and the very point from which Jewish effort has been expended to draw us away. The interest of the protocols at this time is their bearing on the questions, have the Jews an organized world system? What is its policy? How is it being worked? These questions all receive full attention in the protocols. Whosoever was the mind that conceived them possessed a knowledge of human nature, of history, and of statecraft, which is dazzling in its brilliant completeness, and terrible in the objects to which it turns its powers. Neither a madman nor an international criminal, but more likely a supermind, mastered by devotion to a people and a faith, could be the author, if indeed one mind alone conceived them. It is too terribly real for fiction, too well sustained for speculation, too deep in its knowledge of the secret springs of life for forgery. Jewish attacks upon it thus far make much of the fact that it came out of Russia. That is hardly true. It came by way of Russia. It was incorporated in a Russian book published about 1905 by a professor Nihlus, who attempted to interpret the protocols by events then going on or going forward in Russia. This publication and interpretation gave it a Russian tinge, which has been useful to Jewish propagandists in this country, in England, because these same propagandists have been very successful in establishing in Anglo-Saxon mentalities a certain atmosphere of thought surrounding the idea of Russia and the Russians. Of course, they're still at that today with Putin. One of the biggest humbugs ever foisted in the world has been that foisted by Jewish propagandists, principally on the American public, with regard to the temper and genius of the truly Russian people. So, to intimate that the protocols are Russian is partially to discredit them. The internal evidence makes it clear that the protocols were not written by a Russian, nor originally in the Russian language, nor under the influence of Russian conditions, but they found their way to Russia and were first published there. So the protocols are not Russian, they're by way of Russia. They have been found by diplomatic officers in manuscript in all parts of the world. Wherever Jewish power is able to do so, it has suppressed them, sometimes under the supreme penalty. Their persistence is a fact which challenges the mind. Jewish apologists may explain that persistence on the ground that the protocols feed the anti-Semitic temper and therefore are reserved for that service. Certainly there was no wide or deep anti-Semitic temper in the U.S. to be fed, or that felt the greed for agreeable lies to keep itself alive. The progress of the protocols in the United States can only be explained on the ground that they supply light and give meaning to certain previously observed facts. and that this light and meaning is so startling as to give a certain standing and importance to these otherwise unaccredited documents. Sheer lies do not live long. Their power soon dies. These protocols are more alive than ever. They have penetrated higher places than ever before. They have compelled a more serious attitude to them than ever before. The protocols would not be more worthy of study if they bore, say, the name of Theodor Herzl. Their anonymity does not decrease their power any more than the omission of a painter's signature detracts from the art value of a painting. Indeed, the protocols are better without a known source, for if it were definitely known that in France or Switzerland in the year 1896 or thereabouts, a group of international Jews assembled in conference drew up a program of world conquest, it would still have to be shown that such a program was more than a mere vagary, that it was confirmed at large by efforts to fulfill it. The protocols are a world program, there is no doubt of anywhere of that. Whose program is stated within the articles themselves? But as for outer confirmation, which would be the more valuable, a signature or six signatures or 20 signatures or a 25-year unbroken line of effort fulfilling that program? Obviously the latter, you're meant to conclude. The point of interest for this and other countries is not that a criminal or a madman conceived of such a program, but that, when conceived, this program found means of getting itself fulfilled in its most important particulars. The document is comparatively unimportant. The conditions to which it calls attention are of a very high degree of importance. And that's, again, from July 10th, 1920. Concluding this first session on the Protocols of Zion, the prefatory material, introductory material, taken from the Dearborn Independent, Henry Ford's paper on the international Jew, the world's foremost problem. So, thanks for being with me today, and we'll pick it up again next time as we move into an introduction to the Jewish protocols, our protocols, which is, again, from Henry Ford. Thanks for being with me. I'll talk to you again real soon.